Okay, great. Hello. My name is Carol Revelt, and I've been assigned by the commission to kick this technical conference off. And what we'd like to do first is go around the room so that folks on the phone know who all is here, and then we'll follow up by reintroducing the people on the telephone, and then we'll hand it over to the company to provide their presentation. For those on the telephone, we are streaming this, and the presentations have been, if you haven't received them, they are on our website under this particular docket, which is 130-5719. They've been posted there. So, anyways, we'll start with me, Carol Revelt, commission staff.
Dan Martinez with the Office of Consumer Services.
Eric Orton with the Division of Public Utilities.
Kelly Mendenhall with Questar Gas.
Dan Gemmel with the Office.
John Harvey, commission staff.
Gavin Mangelson with the Office.
Jordan White with the Commission.
Becky Wilson, Commission Staff.
Justin Christensen, Division.
Brenda Salter, Division.
Doug Wheelwright, Division.
Carolyn Roll, Division.
Jennifer Clark with Questar Gas.
Courtney Higgins for UAE.
The folks on the phone, could you reintroduce yourself? Oh, I'm sorry. Oops. Go ahead.
Austin Summers with Questar Gas.
Jordan Stevenson, Questar Gas.
Bill Hunt, Questar Gas.
Mike Stackwist, Questar Gas.
Jerry Newman, Questar Gas.
Oh, great. And for those on the phone, could you please reintroduce yourselves?
Yes, this is William Dunkel. I'm a consultant to the DPU on depreciation.
Okay.
This is John Wiedmeyer from Gavin Fleming. I'm a consultant for the company. And this is already followed with the division.
Great. One last thing. I'm going to circulate a sign-in sheet for the folks on in the room, and so we'll just start passing that around. And if you'd sign it in before you leave, that'd be great.
Okay. All right.
Kelly?
So before we get started on depreciation, just wanted to give you a little heads up on what's happening this morning. I don't know if you've been watching gas prices, but at Kern River, we're buying gas at $28 a dekatherm today. So. Now, that's the bad news. The good news is that our gas supply department has kind of seen this coming, and so for the last few days, they've been buying gas at, well, yesterday it was at $8, 2 days ago it was at $6, 3 days ago it was at $5, so the trend was up. But they were able to fill our aquifer storage reservoirs, and so we're talking millions of dollars in savings because we're going to have to buy less gas today and through the weekend. So. They don't get a lot of credit, so I just wanted to tip the hat to them for their foresight there and keeping on top of things. So,
is it just because of the cold weather, or is there something else going on?
Yeah, that's what they're. I guess the pressure on the prices in the East Coast have finally transferred over to us. Now, I think 27 is probably a little speculative. I'm thinking. Well, they're thinking by the weekend it's going to be back down to 10, but that's still a lot higher than what we've seen lately. So
how much are we having to buy? Or are you having to buy?
I think they're buying, and in this temperature environment, they're buying about 300,000 per day.
I mean at the nasty price, not the...
Right, so at the nasty price today, I think they're going to have to buy maybe 100. Their plan is to draw through the whole weekend and keep those purchase prices down. Obviously, Wexpro helps in an environment like this, and we're getting a good share of our volumes from Wexpro as well. So, just thought I'd pass that along. Okay, so we have, looks like, six questions on depreciation, and some of them get pretty technical. So, on some of them, I'm gonna try to keep it at a high level and just kind of explain the question and you know, whether there's an issue or not. So on the first question, we're talking about book depreciation, and they've compared the financial statements to the depreciation study, and they've noticed there's about a $28 million difference in accumulated depreciation between the production product and the general product. So just to give you kind of some background on what I'm talking about when I say product, there's a couple different ways that we can break the costs out. We can break them out by FERC account, which is a really probably the lowest level that we go on our general ledger. So that would be the type of plant. So you're looking at land, mains, services, meters, that's that level of detail. Then we can also break it out by product. So for Questar Gas, there's really only three products. There's production, there's distribution, and then there's general plant. And so basically the plant gets put in one of those categories. Then we also split distribution into two jurisdictions, Utah and Wyoming. So that's kind of where we're at. So what happened, maybe I'll just walk you through how the $20 million difference occurred and then what we need to do to fix it. So back in 2008, our accounting group looked at our buildings, and most of our buildings at that time were sitting in the Distribution Utah product, meaning all of the costs related to those buildings were being allocated to Utah. And they looked at that and said, you know, a lot of these buildings, and this is our operations center, this is the biggest building that was transferred, a lot of these buildings take care of both jurisdictions. You know, our meter shop runs out of this building, our customer service group runs out of this building, our engineering group runs out of this building. So really, they're providing services for both jurisdictions. So rather than assign it all to Utah, we need to split it between the two. So what we did is we took $47 million of buildings, and they had been depreciated $19 million, and we moved $27.9 million over to, from Distribution Utah to General Plant. So there's kind of two systems that our accounting folks use. There's a what's called a fixed asset system, and that's where all the detail lies. So you can go in and drill down on any asset, know when it was acquired, you know, how it's being depreciated. That's where all the detail lies. And then we've got a general ledger that kind of summarizes that, and that's what is used for financial reporting purposes. So what happened is back in 2008, we took the $47 million and we moved it from structures and distribution to structures in general plant. So far, so good, no problems. We made that move in fixed assets and in the general ledger, so everything ties. Where the problem occurred was on the accumulated depreciation. So this 108 is accumulated depreciation. So what happened basically is we moved, remember, $47 million of investment, we moved $47 million of accumulated depreciation over to general. What we should have done is move $19 million over. So basically, that's why you've got a $28 million difference between Utah and general. So what does that mean? Well, it means we need to make an adjustment here, and that adjustment will actually benefit the ratepayers. So what we need to do is we need to move $28 million back out of general over to Distribution Utah. And when we do that, it reduces the revenue requirement by about $110,000, I think. So we've actually done that in December 2013. So on our financial statements, they're correct now. One of the questions kind of talks about, you know, please provide an updated version of the depreciation study. The depreciation study is actually accurate because the depreciation study broke out all their numbers based on FERC account. They didn't even look at the product. So it's not the depreciation study that needed to be fixed. It's the financial statements. So we fix the financial statements, and I would propose that we you know, make a regulatory adjustment to take that into account. So that kind of covers the first question. I don't know if anyone has any additional questions on that.
Kelly?
Yeah.
Not being the accountant that you are, why was it $19 million again? I'm sorry, I just missed that.
$19 million, so...
I mean, I understand everything up to that point, but why it was... Okay, so it's just...
$19 million was the amount that was accumulated. So what we did is we treated it like it was fully depreciated.
Got it.
And there was only $19 million that was depreciated.
Thank you.
So we basically... move more accumulated depreciation over than we needed to.
Okay, thank you.
Yep.
Hey, Kelly, this is Artie.
Yeah.
When you say make a regulatory adjustment, what do you mean?
So,
what are you proposing here?
So basically, the way to fix it in this proceeding would be just to make a $28 million... I mean, you probably don't have the presentation, so I apologize.
No, it's on our list.
I do.
Oh, you do? Okay.
At it.
So we would make... because the general plant gets allocated between Utah and Wyoming, when you move $28 million from general accumulated depreciation to Utah distribution, that ends up reducing rate base for Utah customers. So basically, we would just make an adjustment moving $28 million from the general to the Distribution Utah.
Okay.
and then that would flow through on the return. So basically, the $110,000 I'm talking about is your reduction in return.
So already on that page labeled accumulated depreciation in the last, the boxes on the bottom, Kelly pointed out that you moved the $28 million from the general plant back to the distribution Utah. Is that correct?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So there's a slide titled accumulated depreciation. If you look at the bottom, there's a bullet that says how we fix it, and the entry is kind of shown down there.
Well, I guess what I'm asking is, are you suggesting that the commission do this as part of the rate case order for the revenue requirement?
No.
Or are we making an adjustment in the depreciation?
We're making an adjustment in the depreciation docket. That's a good question. And there's one other one I'm gonna talk about here. So any adjustment that I talk about here today, I would assume would be taken care of in the depreciation docket.
But it has the same effect as reducing the revenue requirement in the rate case.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. Hey. It would just reduce the revenue requirement in the depreciation docket.
Hey, Kelly, can I interrupt you just for a second?
Yeah.
I probably should have said something before, but just so we're all aware that obviously the rate case hearing has been held and a decision is pending. So we just need to be careful that we don't kind of enter into any area that discuss the stipulation or et cetera of the rate case. So I understand that they're tied and there's especially the stipulation, but if we could just try to separate out the two at least for now, that'd be helpful.
Yeah, so going forward, anything I talk about today or any adjustments that I propose or adjustments that I would propose in the depreciation docket, I'm completely ignoring the rate case.
And we recognize that post rate case decision that there may be the need to have another technical conference to maybe discuss whatever the outfall of that is. Enough lawyer talk, sorry about that.
Yeah, and I mean, because this adjustment really is tied to depreciation, so I'm very comfortable proposing it and making it in this docket. It's definitely a depreciation adjustment. So
just to clear it up for me, I want to go to your point, is that the depreciation docket here is coming after the rate case. If the depreciation rates get trued up, would depreciation expense then be adjusted as part of a further rate case order? I'm just talking process.
Okay, let's just talk about process. I mean, I understand that the stipulation basically talks about taking whatever happens in this docket and then flowing it through the bottles.
Right.
So I guess what I suggest is if there's any questions or issues with respect to how the relationship of the outcome of this docket would ultimately flow into that, I'm just not sure this is I think it's, I don't know if it would be appropriate to discuss
I understand what you're saying.
How that would affect, yeah, so okay. Does that make sense?
Yes.
Okay.
All right. If there's no other questions on number one, we'll move on to number two. Okay, so here we're talking about net salvage data error. So I'm just going to run through the questions and then I'll kind of explain what the issue was. So question 2-1, in what accounts other than account 380 service lines was the gross salvage incorrectly classified as removal? 380 was the only place where we had an issue. Q22, were there any other errors in the removal costs or gross salvage data or retirement data for any account in the years 2008 through 2012? If yes, identify these additional errors. There were no additional errors than what we're going to talk about right here. And then question 2-3, provide a corrected version of the summary of book salvage for all accounts that have an error. Okay, so let me maybe walk you through the issue here. Okay, so, and for those of you who are non-accountants, if you start looking at your phone or reading emails, I'm not going to be offended because we're getting into T-accounts, and I totally get it. So, basically what happens is whenever we're retiring something, we have removal costs and sometimes we'll also get a salvage out of it. So basically how that works is, let's take for instance a feeder line replacement. We remove it and we have to incur some costs. What ends up happening, the accounting entries are, we pay $986,000 for cash. We book, the offsetting entry would be $986,000, and this goes to the accumulated depreciation account. So that's one entry. The answer for salvage would be we actually get some money. We're able to sell the, you know, the remaining value to someone for scrap or whatever. Or if it's a vehicle, we can actually get some value out of it. We receive some cash, and then we credit the accumulated depreciation for the same amount. Now, the issue we're talking about in this question is we actually receive some cash for salvage, but we booked it in removal instead of salvage. So I'll show you what impact that has. So basically, this is how we booked it, incorrectly as I mentioned. So at the end of the day, we had $884,000 worth of cash, $953,000 worth of removal, and $69,000 worth of salvage. So we use these numbers to come up with a net salvage number. And how that's calculated is it's removal minus gross salvage is equal to net salvage. And this net salvage number is used by Gannett Fleming as part of the depreciation calculation. They take net salvage into account and it gets incorporated into the rate. So to do the math, you take the $953,000 of removal less the $68,000 of salvage and you end up with a negative salvage of $884,000. So now let's talk about what we should have done. Because this was salvage, we should have booked it over here. And when you book it over into salvage, it changes the numbers. But overall, it doesn't change the net salvage.
Kelly,
I'm going to back up.
For the folks on the phone, I don't know if you're following this, but if you could, you know, tell them, because your little sheet here doesn't show that. But backing up one thing, so number two is a salvage value, and number three was additional salvage value. Is that what this is?
Yes. So number three was some salvage value that we booked as removal when we should have booked it as salvage.
Okay.
So once you correctly book it as salvage, what ends up happening is your removal cost goes from $953,000 up to $986,000. Your salvage goes from $68,000 to $101,000, but your net salvage remains the same because, on the T account, you were making it on the right side of the T account. You were just classifying it incorrectly as salvage or as removal instead of salvage.
For those on the phone on that particular slide for Q2. The number three under cash, $33,000, was previously under removal in the right-hand column, and then it was moved. What should have been done is it moved to the right-hand column under salvage. Is
that's
that correct?
Right. Yep.
So the math at the bottom, how those changes flow through, is shown.
Yep. Okay. So the question asked to provide an updated version of the sheet that this affects. So if you go to the next slide, this is the only sheet that's affected in the depreciation study. It's sheet B10. And if I zoom in to the next slide, you can see I've made the adjustments here for 2010, 2011, 2012. The removal for 2010 goes from $953,000 to $986,000. 2011, it goes from 1.6 to 1.8. 2012 goes from $873,000 to $999,000. And then there's a column that says final amount. That's final salvage. You can see that goes from $68,000 to $92,000. And then it's changed from 2011 goes up to $156,000. And 2012 goes to $126,000. But you'll notice on the net salvage amount, as I showed earlier, that amount it remains unchanged because we're just basically shifting from one category to the other. So it doesn't affect the net salvage, so it also doesn't affect the depreciation rates, but this schedule needs to be adjusted.
Just for clarification, this amount that was in the wrong category, did you effectively change the sign? For example, if it was positive removal and negative salvage, is that what happened?
No, I think, Gary, jump in here. I think we just booked it to the wrong...
Right. Removal is a debit to the reserve and salvage is a credit. So it's the offset of cash. One, you're paying out cash. One, you're getting cash. So it was just classified wrong. The sign did not change, just how it was classified.
So it's a credit in both cases. It was just put in the wrong classification.
Right.
Okay, so I think that covers two. So, any more questions on number two? Okay, number three, we're talking about removal costs and salvage again. So, let me kind of put this in layman's terms. If you look at the table kind of shows what is being asked. If you look at column D...
Now, which table are we looking at?
So now I'm on page 5 of the questions, and I'm looking at the table, and it's got data from 2003 to 2012. It's got retirement amounts, removal costs, and salvage amounts. So if you look at the removal cost in column D, 2003, you know, you start down on line 10 and you're at $1.4 million, but you'll notice a big jump in 2008. We go from, you know, $500,000, $600,000 up to $3.3 million, and then we stay above $1 million all the way through 2012. So removal costs are going up. So one of the questions is why are removal costs gone up so much? And then the next, if you look in column E, we have salvage, and you'll notice salvage kind of goes the other direction. In 2003, we're at $1.3 million, and then in 2008, we dropped down to $300,000, and it stays low. So that's kind of the gist of the question is, why is removal costs going up so much? Why is salvage dropping so much? And the answer is right here on this screen, and it's not Barry. Barry's not the reason why. But you remember, some of you remember this wonderful feeder line tour in Midvale that we went on. So the reason why removal costs are going up so much is because in 2007, really in 2008, we ramped up our feeder line replacement program. Most of you are very familiar with this. So we're spending about $55 million a year replacing high-pressure feeder line. As a result of that, you have removal costs that have increased as well. In fact, I don't know, some of you may have been around long enough to have gone on the feeder line tour down State Street when we replaced State Street. And the area we were working in was so small. Typically, we like to leave the feeder line in place and then build, you know, next to it, because once you dig that thing up, you get to deal with all the contaminants and all the other garbage that's there. Once you dig it up, it's your problem. So we typically like to leave the line in place and build another line, you know, adjacent to it. But in the case of State Street, we didn't have that option, so we had to remove the pipe. This is pipe that was wrapped in asbestos. It was nasty stuff. So we had to pull that out. And we had to get rid of it, and then we put the new pipe in the same spot that it was in. So you'll notice in 2008, that's the highest amount of removal. That's because of the State Street project. I think you know, we spent $2.5 million just on that one project alone. And I think, trying to remember who was there in the rain. Eric, you were there in the rain. We went to Theater Line 12 on 9th West,
West,
former Superfund site. And we had to review or basically check every single shovel of dirt that came out of there to make sure that it was not contaminated. So those removal costs are expensive. So basically, that's why your removal costs have gone up. It's associated with the feeder line replacement project. Now, salvage is a different story. The reason why salvage has gone up is actually, or gone down, is because of our backhoes. In 2007, 2008, we looked at our backhoe process, and what we were doing is we were turning our backhoes every 2 years, you know, trading them in and getting new ones. And someone looked at that, did an economic analysis and said this would be, we'd be much better off if we kept the backhoes longer. Just from a, you know, cost perspective. A lot of us make the same kind of analysis when we buy or lease cars, or, you know, decide how often am I going to turn my car. So we made this analysis, and now we actually hold backhoes, it's like 8 to 10 years. But as a result, just like when you turn in your car 10 years later versus 2 years later, the amount you get for it is lower. And so that's what's driven the salvage amount down, is that our backhoes were holding longer. We were getting a lot of money for our backhoes, but now we're not getting as much money. So that explains why the salvage has dropped so much over the last 10 years. So I think that may have covered So one of the questions is it Questar's position that it's coincidence that the amount of state of gross salvage has decreased while the removal costs have increased? Well, I guess it's coincidence that we started our feeder line replacement program and changed our backhoe policy about the same time. But yeah, that's kind of the explanation of why that's occurring.
Yeah, I have a few questions here.
Sure.
First of all, the backhoe, what account is that in? Is that power equipment?
It's a power equipment.
396.
396, yes.
Yeah, 396. All right. Looking at the chart, now we're talking about the removal cost.
Okay.
So I certainly understand when you're doing removal, you can have costs of removal incurred. If you look at 2006 in the retirement column, we retired $62 million worth in 2006, which is several times what you retired in 2008. So the fact, in fact, in 2008, you did not retire as much as you did in 2006. So this does not really show any accelerated retirements.
Well, the retirements are going to be pretty low for these feeder lines because most of them have been in the ground for 50 years, 60 years. So actually, we're finding, and correct me if I'm wrong here, Mike and Gary, but our removal costs are higher than our retirement costs for these feeder lines, right? Because give me an example of some of these feeder lines we've been retiring in the last few years. It's less than $1 million, isn't it? Just because, you know, back in 1950 or whenever these things were built, the investment was so low.
Right.
So I don't know if you can make a correlation between removal costs and retirement as far as feeder lines go.
What caused the huge retirement costs in 2006?
I don't know. Do you guys know?
Right on.
We can look into that. But yeah, I don't know off the top of my head.
Well, if you look at the retirement data, it's not very different after 2008 than it is before 2008. If anything, it's a little bit higher before. Let's just call it, you know, fairly consistent retirement levels. So if we have fairly consistent retirement levels, I still don't see why the cost of removal should jump drastically. That doesn't make sense.
Well, it makes sense to me because going back once again to the State Street example, if you were to go and look at that feeder line, I don't know how much that feeder line cost to put in, but if you looked at how much was on our books, my guess is that it would be under $1 million. But the actual cost to dig that line up, check for all the contaminated earth, get rid of the asbestos wrapped pipe, is going to be a hefty amount of money. And so I guess what I'm saying is, if you're trying to draw some kind of comparison and say, well, your retirement should be, you know, increasing and trending up at the same rate as your removal costs, I kind of disagree with that. Because the feeder lines are so old that the book value that we have on our books for those are going to be low. And so I would agree with you that our feeder line replacement program probably is not going to impact our overall retirements that much from year to year, just because we're not retiring that much in investment. It's the removal costs that are really expensive.
Okay, let's compare 2008 to 2005. Both are 14 to 16 million retirements.
Yep.
Is it your claim that if I looked at the age of the retirement in 2008 would be very old, whereas the age of retirement in 2005 would not be anywhere near that old? Is that what you're claiming?
I have no idea. I have no idea what's being retired. But I would tell you that the feeder line replacement retirements would be a very small amount of that $10.7 million number.
The what?
The feeder line retirement amounts would be a very small component of that $10.7 million.
Are you looking at 2005?
You're looking at 2009.
You wanted 2008.
Oh, well,
Kelly, this is Joe Wiedmeyer.
Yeah.
In 2006, the $62 million that was shown as a retirement amount, nearly all of that is general plant assets, you know, with about $24 million of that being computer hardware and computer software, which you don't receive any salvage for or incur any removal costs for. The reason why we do the net salvage analysis at the plant account level rather than the total company level is because general plant account generally doesn't experience any removal costs or salvage for the majority of the accounts, with the exception being things like power operated equipment, the backhoes would receive salvage, and vehicles would, you would receive salvage for the vehicles. So I just thought that, you know, sometimes it's, you have to drill down a little bit finer than rather just rely on a very high level schedule that's presented here.
Is the company getting any additional charge to the ratepayers as a result of the feeder line replacement program?
Yeah.
Yes?
Yes. In fact, we have a feeder line tracker. We make adjustments twice a year to get those replacements in rates.
Okay. So, this cost of removal that's affecting the depreciation rates, according to you, is caused largely by the feeder line replacement program, but you're recovering that somewhere else separately, right?
No, the removal, does the removal go into the tracker filing?
No, it's on the 108 side.
So. Well, but we include the 108 in the tracker filing.
Yeah, it's in there.
Yeah.
Right, well, I guess my follow-up question then is, please reconcile, or if there's a double recovery, essentially, let us know, and if not, explain why there's not. You understand what I'm talking about a double recovery?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, I can't answer your question right here, but feel free to ask us a data request, or if you want, we can. I think you've asked this question in your data request. We can try and review that. And by all means, if I'm double counting anything, I'm more than happy to remove it.
All right.
I'm not trying to pull a fast one on anybody. So I'm more than happy to look at the data, and if it turns out that we are double counting the data, I'm more than happy to make that adjustment.
Right. You understand what I meant by double counting, that if the cost of removal is being caused in large part by the feeder replacement program and you're covering that in a separate charge, then we need to look at that.
I think I understand what you're saying, but I think we can talk offline.
All right, thank you.
Yep. Any more questions on 3?
Kelly, that $62 million, I think that's about when the vintage retirement started. So once you start on that treadmill, you're going to have a big bump up.
I do have one more question here, a couple.
On 3?
Yes, on 3. Around 2006 to 2008, your company changed the way it handled third-party reimbursement.
I don't know. Did we change the way we?
No. Not that I'm aware of. DOT.
Our accounting folks are saying no.
I don't think anything has changed.
Did around that time, did you change the way you handle what is called a reuse salvage? And is salvage where the equipment is reused by the company after retirement?
We have any reuse salvage.
We don't have any reuse salvage.
Okay.
Now, our as I mentioned, our salvage value changed because of the change to the backhoes. But,
right.
Yeah, I don't think we have reuse salvage.
Okay. Thank you.
The gentleman over here, you made it. I didn't quite get your comment on.
Well, there was the question on the $62 million retirement for 2006.
Uh-huh.
When we did the initial depreciation study, what that did is for a lot of the general plant, put it on vintage retirement. So a set life was set. So at the end of 4 years, you would retire investment off your books, regardless of whether it was physically good or bad. So once you get on that treadmill, there's going to be a big bump because you're going to look at all your assets for whatever life it is and you're going to retire them.
Oh, that was from the last.
Well, I guess I'm just assuming that's probably what it was. I don't have the detail with me.
Yeah.
But I know when we first got on that treadmill of doing vintage retirements, there would have been a big jump.
And is there a definition of vintage retirements?
Yes.
What does that mean?
Vintage means you retire an asset based on age, based on, if it's, buy it today, it's a 2014 vintage. So if that asset has a four-year life, 4 years from now, you're going to look at that vintage and retire it regardless. You don't track whether it's being used or not. It's automatically.
Oh, I see. It's like computer equipment and those
right.
kinds
it's
of things.
It's all the general
yeah.
plant stuff, a lot of your okay. smaller stuff, your small tools. So that is put in what they call a vintage retirement account, and that at a set life, it is retired.
Thank you.
Retired from an accounting perspective or actual use perspective?
Accounting. Perspective.
So you could still use it, but it wouldn't be on the rates, or it would be fully depreciated for rate purposes, yeah.
So if you have tools, you may depreciate them in X number of years, even though you use them considerably.
Forever, right, yep.
It may break in 2 years, but you depreciate it for four, or it may last 10 years and you retire it for.
Yep.
So if that was the case, every so often, then you would see a bump up, wouldn't you?
Well, but that only happened, I believe, with the last depreciation study. It was the first time we went to vintage retirements.
Right, but if you do stamp vintage retirements, then every four, however many years, you
well,
would...
Well, but the first time you get on that treadmill, you're going to see a bump, because you'd have assets that maybe 8 to 10 years...
Okay, I see what you're saying. Okay.
The first time you implement yeah. vintage retirements, you're going to have...
Then we're buying assets every year, and
so
yeah. it
then
just stays
it's just,
at
okay,
a high
so
level.
It's just that initial adjustment. Okay. Thank
yeah.
you.
Okay, issue number four. I'm going to pitch this one to John from Gannett Fleming. So this is kind of talking about the curves that are used to come up with the rates.
Right. Yeah. This is a you know a pretty technical question or issue. We've explained the methodology in our report. So on page 24 and 25 of our report. There's a section called Computer Mortality Method, which describes the manner in which the company's retirement data was statistically aged so that we were able to develop retirements by age or vintage year. Once we have statistically aged data, retirement data, we study it in the same manner that you would analyze age data that you had the actual age of the vintage when an asset was retired. So if you retired a Maine in 2006 that was put in service in 1956, you know the age of that property, that Maine lasted 50 years. We study these aged retirements, whether they're actual age retirements or statistically aged retirements, by the retirement rate method. And we develop life tables that are shown in Appendix A of our depreciation study report. So this question is asking for the amounts that are shown on page A15 of the depreciation study report. Page A15 of the depreciation study report presents the life table for account 380 services. And what we try and do is we try and fit a generalized Iowa type survivor curve to the company's actual data points that are shown in this life table, which we refer to as the original survivor curve. There's a very helpful explanation in our report on page 11 through 18 that illustrates and provides an example of how these amounts are determined or developed when you construct the life table. And the life table is the fundamental task when you're doing an actuarial analysis. The task that you need to do is construct this life table. Essentially, this life table illustrates the dollars that were exposed to retirement at a certain age versus, well, how many dollars did get retired at that age, age 1 or age 2 or age 50? And they're all shown in that life table. Each age has its own survivor ratio and its own retirement ratio. So the retirement ratio would just simply be the dollars that were retired during that age interval, let's say age 1 or age 2, and how many dollars were exposed to retirement. So that the retirement ratio is simply taking the retirement amount experienced during that age interval and dividing it by the dollars that are shown in the exposure column, which would be in the denominator. You would get the retirement ratio in that manner.
Okay, John, I have a question here. Thank you for that explanation. But let's go back to the question, which is 401. And you discussed that there's two types of data, the actuarially aged and the statistically aged. And you did the second one. Our question is, in developing this statistically aged data, what Iowa curve and life did you assume in order to create that what appears to be the historic data?
Okay. There is no one specific survivor curve that is selected, Bill, as an input to statistically age the retirements. What we do is we select a curve type, such as an R2 or an R3 or an S2 type curve.
Talk about what you actually did in account 380.
Yeah, Bill, I think your premise of your question is a little bit, it's not correct the way that it's worded. I think it's based on a false premise.
Well, let me just ask it very simply. When in account 380, in this actual case, when you're preparing what you present on this page as being the observed life table, what type of Iowa curve did you use as a input in that calculation?
I have that. Let me just pull it up.
Okay.
Okay, for account 380, for the last 5 years since the last depreciation study, we used an S2 type curve. Each time we do these 5-year service life studies, we can select a different curve type based upon the indications of what curve we should use from the SPR life analysis.
Okay, now for this same account, and again the same table on this page we talked about, you were using an S2. What life did you assume in the S2 for purposes of creating this original life table?
Okay. Each year since the last study, 2008 through 2012, there is not one specific survivor curve that's used. Each year uses a different combination of average service life and curve type to statistically age the retirements, because the retirement amounts in 2008 might be twice what was experienced in 2012, for example. So,
let's go through this account, this page. What was the curve and life you used in the year 2008 to prepare this observed life table?
I don't have that at my fingertips, Bill. I know you asked that as a data request in set 3. I'd be willing to add that one on as another part to, I think it's EPU.
What I'm looking for specifically, I assume for 2008 you can give us an answer, something like a 40S1, something along that line. Or you S2, you said you used S2. So 2008 might be a 40S2. 2009 might be a 50S2. Is that the type of thing we'll see?
Yes, Bill. We can provide you every year what the computer picked, because what it does, it systematically adjusts the life upward and downward, using programmatically until a life which most closely produces a difference between the actual balance and the simulated balance is detected for that 1 year. For that 1 year, right. We go 1 year at a time. So 1 year might be a 41.58 S2, and then the next year it might be a 38.75 S2. It adjusts.
Use the balance method or retirement method? You matching the balances?
We're matched. That's a different process, but we're using the balances, this SPR balances method, to select a curve type. To then our next step is to statistically age the data using computed mortality.
Right. Okay. And we also have a request in discovery for that analysis that you did, that you just discussed too. Right.
Right.
Okay.
But each year we do that SPR analysis, looking at the most recent five-year bands, because we're only using the SPR analysis as an interim step to statistically age the data using the computed mortality method.
Okay, and if you only used, you did this since 2008, what did you use before then? Just whatever was one of the prior studies?
Right.
Okay.
So there's three time periods that we did. We probably did the first one we would have done in around 2004 time frame, and then 4 or 5 years later, 2008 or 9 time frame, and then last year.
Okay. That's helpful, and I look forward to the discovery responses that will have the details we're looking for.
Okay, Bill. We'll provide that.
Thank you.
I wouldn't mind moving on. I appreciate the dialogue you two are having, but I think there's 20 people in this room that don't even know what you're talking about. So if we need to have more discussions, maybe we can do that offline.
Right. We're done with this issue.
Okay, so let's move to issue number 5. Okay, so let's just go through the questions and I'll kind of explain what we're talking about here. So please explain how account 399, communications equipment, and account 380, other equipment, are directly related to asset retirement costs. Actually, I think in our model, we have labeled 399 communications equipment and 380 other equipment. That's incorrect. So what I did is I went out and I pulled this is right out of our financial statements, and you can see this is actually the correct categorization. So I apologize. We probably confused people by naming it wrong in our model, and we'll fix it in our model. But 388 is asset retirement cost distribution, and 399 is asset retirement costs general. And those basically, the SEC requires us to, for financial reporting purposes, if we have assets on our books. In the case of these assets, it's mostly storage tanks for both gasoline and natural gas. So because there's some remediation and reclamation that takes place when those are removed, we're required to book those almost as a liability on our books. What's weird is that they're booked as an asset. And this question kind of alludes to the fact that we're double counting, and they're right. And as I talked to John from Gannett, if you think about it, these costs are basically, they're not really costs. They're just liabilities that we think we're going to have to pay in the future. So we're not having to fund these. We're not having to pay for these right now. We're just having to note that they exist. And so for us to include those two accounts in rate base is incorrect. I think the best treatment in talking with John how these are treated throughout the industry is these are removed from rate base for rate making purposes. So once again, in this proceeding, because this is a depreciation-related issue, I would say we removed the depreciation amounts and the asset amounts related to 388 and 399. I think we ran it through our model, and it was about a $40,000 adjustment down. So that kind of answers that question, unless there's any other questions on it. Okay, moving on.
I think the 40,000 is the rate base return, and then you'd also do some depreciation.
Well, I think when you remove it from rate base, it
Oh, yeah.
It takes care of depreciation as well. Right. Yeah. So, on to issue number 6, production plant depreciation. Why is depreciation plant not included in the study? So, let me give you some background on our production plant. So, what this is before Wexpro 1 was contemplated in, was it 81?
Mm-hmm. That's when it was finished. It started in 78.
Right. So this is prior production plant that the company owned before Wexpro 1. Basically, it's been sitting on our books and depreciating since then. So you've got about $81 million in production plant. Most of the, you know, that includes wells, leaseholds, structures, a whole bunch of equipment in there. Everything by now is pretty much fully depreciated with the exception of the wells and the leaseholds. So the wells and the leaseholds are depreciated on a units of production method, meaning we have a certain amount of asset, we go out, we figure out what we think our probable reserves are, and then we depreciate, you know, per year on a per decatherm basis based on how many volumes we have left before the wells and the leaseholds are gone. So why aren't they in the study? Well, most of the equipment that I think we would want Gannon Fleming to review is fully depreciated. So the structures and the purification equipment, stuff like that, is fully depreciated. If the commission decided that they wanted, or if the division decided that they wanted to review the production plan, in our opinion, that would really be in the wheelhouse of the Wexpro monitor. Because since 1981, all of the production assets that we purchased go on Wexpro's books. So the monitor has a pretty good understanding of you know, how those assets work, how they're depreciated, has an understanding of our properties. So I guess if that's something the commission wants to do, that would, or if the division wants to do, that would kind of be the route I would think we should take. Now, there is only about $7 million left, so yeah, I guess it becomes a materiality issue of how, you know, how important it is to review. But in my talking with Dan Fleming, units of depreciation is a fairly straightforward depreciation method, so I don't know how much studying they could do on that issue. So that's Greg, that. Go ahead.
Talking about some of the production plant is fully depreciated, and therefore, of course, you do not depreciate it further.
Right.
In your general plant accounts, buildings, are any of those buildings now fully depreciated?
There isn't any general in production. We don't have any.
No, he's talking about buildings in general plant.
Account 390.
The account in total is not, I don't know about specifics. Do you know about any specific buildings?
Whether or not they're fully depreciated?
Yeah.
Some are. I mean, their buildings are being, you know, we just built a new one up in Park City that's on the 390 account, so that one is not. But.
Yeah, so the answer I'm getting is some of them probably are, but there are certainly a bunch that aren't. Right. So it's probably a mixed bag.
Yes.
But
as you just said, if they're fully depreciated, we cease depreciating. I don't see in the depreciation study where any of the buildings have been treated as fully depreciated. That is, you're not.
No, I'm talking. We're talking production plant right now. So I believe, okay. I believe there's a structures account. I don't have the financial statements in front of me, but I believe we have some structures in production plant. That's all I'm talking about.
All right.
So my understanding is that the structures that are related to the production plant are fully depreciated.
That's true.
But you just said that there could be in the general plant structures, there could be some in there that are fully depreciated as well. Is that what?
Probably, yeah, there probably are.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's.
But I believe Gannett reviewed those structures, right?
They are.
John, you reviewed those structures in the general plant, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
We broke out 10 of your largest locations, and we depreciate those 10 locations separately, give them their own lifespan and depreciation parameters. And then there's all other category that has all other smaller locations that we depreciate that. So if there were, let's say there's 15 other small locations that get depreciated in that all other category, There may be one or two that are fully depreciated, and that would be, we treat it as a mass property group, so it's not specifically identified as fully accrued or fully depreciated, but effectively that's what would be, that's effectively what would happen to the depreciation rate. If they're that old, they would, they would be fully depreciated.
In your study, you're still applying the depreciation rate to the fully depreciated investment, right? I mean, I don't see any...
Well, it's a composite rate, Bill. It's a weighted average rate. You know, if you have 15, I don't know how many locations we have. It's a small account, $4.5 million. So it would be a composite rate that we were calculating.
Were none of the 10 largest ones fully depreciated using the actual book reserve on the company books?
That's correct. They're all relatively young buildings.
All right, 6-2. In a general rate case, what percent of the production plant depreciation and depletion expense is allocated to the Utah Regulated Services? So the answer to that is about 96%. So typically, we allocate production plant on decatherms sold, excluding transportation. And if you do that, you end up allocating about 96% to Utah. Now, we allocate a lot of things on different factors. Some we do on gross plants, some we do on... really, it's just gross plant, and I guess you could do customers as well. But it seems to be, no matter what you allocate, which factor you allocate, it always ends up being right around 96-97% goes to Utah. So, and then number three, I think I answered that one. If we wanted to review the wells, the Wexpro monitor probably has the expertise to do that.
So I have a question. You know, you were saying that on this units of depreciation for the wells,
yeah,
and that you figure out their the amount of production that you would get from them. And
right.
Then you could, but if you go in and do a workover, or you go in and do some other new technology, it increases the,
yep,
product, you would go and adjust for that.
Yep. In fact, don't they adjust those rates every year?
Every year, the reservoir engineers will go in and look and say, okay, this is the estimated remaining reserves in that well. So they do a calculation based on current production versus estimated remaining reserves.
And they may have produced more in 2013 than they thought, so that goes into the adjustment as well. Yep. So that's calculated annually. All right, so I guess we have a couple... follow-ups we need to make with Mr. Dunkel. Are there any other questions? I think we've made it through. All right. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thanks.
Thanks. Hey, thank you, Bob.
Thanks.